service.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis Media. Jim Morrison died at the age of 27, and he lived a life of self-inflicted turbulence. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 11 would be the number on a scale of 1 to 10 that Jim would approach while performing on stage. He screamed louder, cursed more, jumped higher. Even on nights when he missed most of the notes, he still gave a performance. 12 more would be the number of weeks the Doors would hold on to the coveted spot of house band at the Whiskey A Go-Go on the Sunset Strip, before Jim's hatred of authority and foul mouth got them kicked out for good. Another 1 would be the number of Walt Disney-affiliated studios he hosed down with a fire extinguisher, buck naked. And 3 would be the number of years he'd have left to live after the man who would become Iggy Pop witnessed Jim give a beautifully destructive performance in Detroit. On this, our third episode of Season 2, Foul Mouths, Fire Extinguishers, Beautiful Destruction, and Jim Morrison Lost in Another Fantasy. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Phil Tanzini couldn't believe what he had just heard. His ears were hot. He was enraged. He was shocked. And Tanzini did his shock easily. His ears were hot with the filth coming from the mouth of Jim Morrison. He wouldn't be surprised in the least if someone told him in that moment that smoke was literally coming from his ears. His nostrils flared and a shudder surged through his body. Tanzini stood up from a desk in the office at the back of the Whiskey A Go-Go, stood up so fast that he banged his knee on the desk drawer, hard. The pain in his knee only added to the frustration he was feeling. He lost it. Fuck! He hopped on one foot, grabbed his knee with his hands, and tried to rub the pain out. He had to move, quickly. And the atmosphere in the whiskey was getting X-rated real fast, and Tanzini had to bring the hammer down. He'd drag Jim Morrison off the stage by his long hair if he had to. Pull the plug on the equipment, something, anything to make it stop. He could hear Jim on stage doubling down on his initial obscenities with cathartic shouts into the overloaded microphone. Kill. Fuck. Kill. Fuck. It was August 1966, and the Doors were dragging out an especially loud, climactic rendition of the end. Robbie Krieger played the repetitive Eastern guitar vamp over and over like he was in a trance. And Ray Manzarek made his Vox organ squeal while his left hand held down the looped bass line. John Densmore brought his jazz chops to the forefront with some well-timed fills that exploded like bombs. And the whole band was buzzing with tension and release. And they would get loud and unhinged, Jim shrieking into the mic, and then tighten everything up and get quiet again. It was in those moments of quiet that Jim began to slowly turn the song into theater. Obscene theater. His unrehearsed ramble in front of a stunned crowd was a reductive take on Oedipus Rex, and his final lines were what made Tanzini leap from his chair like a bat out of hell. Father, I want to kill you. Jim wrapped one of his black leather-clad legs around the microphone stand, rubbed his crotch against the long metal pole the way that he always did, the way that made the girls in the audience lose their shit. It wasn't suggestive, it wasn't coded, it was blatant. And this was why the girls and boys flocked to the Whiskey in the summer of 66, to see this aloof, elegantly wasted rock god ooze effortless sex all over the Sunset Strip. And he didn't disappoint. He never disappointed. But then things got weird. Father, I want to kill you. Jim regained a balance on the stage floor, leaned into the microphone stand, and looked up toward the club's low ceiling. No one moved. The go-go dancers stopped moving in their suspended cage. The audience ground to a halt. Waitresses stopped serving drinks. All eyes were on Jim, eyes shut tight as he made his assault on the mic. Mother, I want to fuck you. All night long. Tanzini knew that Jim was going to push him over the edge. Ever since they had hired the Doors to be the Whiskey's house band back in May, He wouldn't say how or when, he couldn't, but he knew it would happen. And Jim had been pushing his buttons for months now. He was arrogant, he was condescending, he racked up an absurd bar tab, and he was searching for buttons to push, hell-bent on biting the hand that fed his band. He found the button in Tanzini. He pushed it, and this was the moment, the button moment. It was happening right now. Another one of the Whiskey's owners, Elmer Valentine, could be a little softer with the bands, even if his background suggested otherwise. Valentine was a former Chicago cop who made his way to LA after being indicted for extortion. In Chi-Town, his side hustle was running nightclubs for the mob, was on their payroll. And to Valentine and other cops at the time, it was the way things were. It wasn't dirty, it just was what it was, a means to an end. Valentine was never convicted, but he got out of town, headed west, and redefined himself as a club owner. And since he had some experience under his belt, after running PJs in West Hollywood, Valentine took a trip to Europe and discovered discotheques. He brought the concept back to LA and helped make the Whiskey a Go-Go the preeminent place for live rock music in the city, perhaps even in the entire country. And he never let those wise guy connections dry up. When the Whiskey opened, he signed Johnny Rivers to play regularly for a year. Mr. Secret Agent Man himself, Bill Gazzari, another LA club owner, claimed that Valentine stole Rivers from his place, and he wanted Johnny Rivers back. Valentine could go fuck himself. Gazzari put in a call to the infamous Chucky English, one of Sam Giancana's top men in Chicago. And Chucky English made the trip across the country to the Whiskey and laid it out real nice. Johnny Rivers goes back to Gazzari's, or Valentine was a fucking dead man. Valentine remained calm. He got on the phone, ran back home to Chicago. Felix Aldericio, aka Milwaukee Phil, aka a hitman's hitman with at least 14 confirmed mafia kills, he was a close friend of Valentine's. Valentine needed him to come out to LA and do him this favor. Get this fucking Gazzari fuck off his back. And so he did. And so that was that. It was settled. Johnny Rivers kept playing the Whiskey. The Whiskey didn't feel mobbed up. It felt like the coolest room on the planet. The Whiskey's cigarette girl, Patty Brockhurst, was also its house DJ. Valentine wanted patrons to keep dancing between bands. And since there wasn't enough room on the floor for a DJ booth, a glass-walled booth was mounted above the floor, where Patty would spin LPs and dance in her miniskirt. It was such a hit that Valentine hired some additional dancers to join Patty. The crowd shook their asses nonstop, following the direction of the women suspended from the dance cage above. The Whiskey-A-Go-Go turned the strip into the promised land, the scene to end all scenes. Ray Manzarek called it Mecca, even if its glamorous commercialized scene was the exact opposite of the bohemian artist's fantasy they had concocted on Venice Beach. The Whiskey attracted Hollywood elite. Cary Grant, Jane Mansfield, Steve McQueen, Jack Parr, they all got their rocks off at 8901 Sunset Boulevard. As the Whiskey-A-Go-Go's house band, the doors opened for Buffalo Springfield, The Byrds, Love, Captain Beefheart, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, The Turtles, When Them came into town, their frontman Van Morrison went on a bender for days with Jim. They sang G-L-O-R-I-A on stage together. Two brothers from other mothers, a duo of Morrisons for the ages right there on the Sunset Strip. Earlier in that year, the Doors had secured a recurring gig at the London Fog. The club was a few doors down from the Whiskey, but not nearly as respected. At least they were Whiskey adjacent, they were in the orbit, and they were where the action was. But the Doors had no draw, and the Fog wasn't consistent with payment. Serendipitously, Ronnie Mellon, the Whiskey's talent booker, saw the Doors at the Fog on the night they were let go. She went back and told Valentine that they needed to be the Whiskey's house band. Now, Tanzini was regretting the whole thing, regretting ever allowing Jim Morrison to defile the stage, to rub his tight pants on the mic stand, to howl like a wounded animal, to play his music way too fucking loud, to say the kinds of things a normal person just wouldn't say on stage. You sick fuck, Tanzini was screaming as he approached the stage. You say that sick shit about your mother? On my stage? On my stage? Who the fuck do you think you are to say that sick shit on my stage? Then Tanzini fired the band, and they were done. He was all out of patience with Jim being all out of fucks. The cush gig they had won over every other band in LA was taken away from them, just like that. And it was all Jim's fault. The Doors knew there was a caveat that came with having Jim Morrison as their frontman. This was the caveat. But Jim wasn't just a liability on stage in front of an audience. He didn't even need an audience. He slipped deeper into that fantasy world, felt himself more invincible as the months went on and the band gained notoriety. His act wasn't merely attention-seeking. He was all in. So far in that it was almost second nature when he took off all of his clothes and lit up the recording studio with a loaded fire extinguisher. Paul Rothchild stepped outside the New Jersey State Prison for the first time in 9 months and felt that early morning July sun smack him in the face. It was hot and muggy. Felt like summer, smelled like Trenton. He didn't take the moment for granted. That Jersey sun could smack the ever-loving shit out of him all day if it wanted to. He'd soak it up. The maximum security behemoth dwarfed Rothchild where he stood, waiting for the gates to ceremoniously open. His balding head a little more bald than when he was first put in the cell 9 months earlier. Holy shit, he thought. 9 months. He can grow a human being in 9 months. He had done his time with murderers, thieves, racketeers, and psychopaths, as well as those who, like himself, were there because of some petty bullshit. Rothschild was there for a couple of joints, if you could believe that. He couldn't. Marijuana possession. In the mid-60s, the police had raging hard-ons to bust people smoking grass. Fringe folk, hippies, rock and rollers. So the squares put him inside the Trenton Fortress and did their best to make him feel like a different person. A normalized person. A reformed person. The 9 months Rothschild spent inside were full of monotony. There was no music, no work, and certainly no grass. But you couldn't stamp the music out of Paul Rothschild. Rothschild was Elektra Records' senior staff producer. He was hired by Elektra president Jack Holtzman in 1963. He had produced records by folkies like Phil Oakes and Tom Rush. In 64, he discovered the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. When he was sent to jail in November 1965, Holzman kept him on the payroll. It was only 9 months, and Elektra would be waiting for him when he got out. And now, there he was, the one Elektra and Holzman were waiting for, standing there under the hot July sun, receding hairline, dramatic mutton chops on his cheeks, beads around his neck, sandals on his feet, unlit cigarette behind his ear. Real fucking far from reformed. But how would he do this? How would he acclimate back into reality? Who would he work with? Who would want to work with him, a producer with a rap sheet? Jack Holzman had the perfect group. That summer, Arthur Lee of Love, Elektra's first rock group and a quintessential example of the mid-60s psychedelic folk rock scene in L.A., brought Holzman to the Whiskey. He had to see this band. Their singer was wild, unpredictable, raw, unique, and the band really cooked. It took Holzman a repeat visit, but he got turned on. And the doors had been dicked around by Columbia Records, signed and then sat on with little enthusiasm by the label's brass. They had been picked up and dropped with a little fanfare, and they needed a place to go. Holzman needed another exciting rock band to continue to diversify Elektra's roster. The doors were gonna blow people's minds. Or, as LA critic Gene Youngblood said, the Beatles and the Stones are for blowing your mind. The doors are for afterwards, when your mind is already gone. The Doors welcomed Rothschild with open arms. A record producer fresh out of the joint for smoking dope? Fuck yes. That was the only icebreaker the band needed, and they were all in. Rothschild and The Doors checked into Sunset Sound Recorders in Hollywood, a studio that Disney's director of recording, Tootie Camerata, had built in the late 50s at Walt Disney's request. Used at first to record music for vintage Disney films, it would become a legendary spot where the Beach Boys would make pet sounds. The Stones would finish Exile on Main Street. Janis Joplin would record Pearl, and Prince would track Purple Rain. In 6 days, The Doors were done. They tracked Light My Fire, Break On Through to the Other Side, Soul Kitchen, Backdoor Man, The End, along with the other 6 songs that would make up their groundbreaking self-titled debut album. The band was picking up steam. Their sound was new and hungry. They put the drama of the Whiskey behind them. But Jim wasn't done with all the drama yet. There was other drama to find and exploit. He wasn't done with the theater yet either. And there were still words he hadn't said, things he hadn't done, people he hadn't shocked. He wasn't done with the fantasy. The Doors were trying to record The End when Jim, stoned and ranting, decided to rip the television cord out of the wall and smash it to shit. He hurled it towards Rothschild in the control room of the studio, but the boxy TV was stopped by the large wall of soundproof glass separating the control room and the studio. Jim was shocked the glass didn't break. It was a letdown, anticlimactic. Rothschild cut the session short. Jim obviously needed to sleep this one off. Rothschild put him in a car and had someone drive him home. But Jim didn't make it home. Jim wasn't done, had to finish what he started. He bailed out of the car as it was rolling down Sunset Boulevard, just like he had bailed to kiss the 14-year-old that time on Hawthorne. He ran down Sunset, moaning and groaning so loud that he fit in perfectly with the human wildlife crawling around at this late hour on the streets. When he made it back to Sunset Sound, everyone was gone. And then he saw smoke coming from the building's windows. Jesus, he thought. They kick him out of the studio and then the place catches on fire? He climbed the gate and found his way into the empty building. He could tell the fire was coming from the studio room they had been recording in. He had to do something. He was sweating and panting from all the running. He was already hot, and he just got hotter and hotter the closer he got to the studio room with the fire inside. His heart beat wildly and his arms shook with unchecked adrenaline. It was time to go full wild child. It was time to get real feral. And Jim took his clothes off, took them all off. He felt free, loose, unfettered, fucking invincible. He burst into the room and used his clothes to try to smother the flames. Threw his shirt down on some fire, it smoldered. Threw his jeans down on some fire, and they seemed to do the trick. But there was too much fire, too much smoke. He didn't have that many clothes. And frustrated, he threw ashtrays around the room, upended a table. If it wasn't bolted down, it got tossed. And then he grabbed the fire extinguisher from the wall and let it rip, sprayed down the whole room. The crackling of the flames and the white noise surge of the fire extinguisher filled his ears with beautiful cacophony. Foam from the fire extinguisher covered everything, the control board, the tapes, John Densmore's drums, and Robbie Krieger's guitar. Not an inch of the room was missed. Jim was thorough. He was both a hero and a wild force of destruction. He could have his cake and eat it too. As the fire extinguisher sputtered its last final blast of white foam, Jim collapsed in a chair, exhausted, fulfilled. He had finished what he'd started. Later that night, Rothschild found Jim nearly passed out in that chair, and the entire room covered in chemical foam. It was like a marshmallow crime scene. He shook Jim awake, who was babbling about a fire. A fire? Rothschild was confused and angry. There was no fire. It was just a studio room entirely covered in goo and a bunch of random shit thrown around and smashed. Damn, Jim, Rothschild said. Took a real beautiful thing. Fucked it up good. Jim, still naked and out of his mind, smiled. At times like these, the devilish encouragement and hostility of his friend Jimbo bounced around in his head. Even when Jimbo wasn't standing right next to him, Jimbo was always there, always commenting, always provoking. Even if Jim was naked and alone in a recording studio, he wasn't really ever alone. And yeah, Rothschild was right, he did fuck it up. He fucked it up real good. But it was a private act of insanity. It shocked Rothschild, a guy who'd recently spent time in the big house and didn't shock easily. But Jim needed a bigger audience, a bigger stage, pass the insanity along to the masses, and they were thirsty for it anyway. 20,000 unsuspecting hippies in a public park was a good place to start.
We'll be right back after this
word.
Jim Morrison and Jimbo made the scene. Jim tagged along behind Jimbo. Jimbo looked out onto the crowd of 20,000 people gathered in Golden Gate Park and thought, fuck these flower children. Fuck this grassroots activism and fuck these wild-eyed, deluded losers. President Kennedy was still dead, and after Watts, Cleveland had rioted. Omaha had rioted. And there were almost 200,000 U.S. soldiers in Vietnam. The world was a ball of confusion, and these starry-eyed, optimistic fools thought that holding hands in the middle of San Francisco would make things better. At least the folks in Watts knew what was up. Fuck shit up, make it sting, make the establishment feel the pain. The human being. Even the name was stupid. Life was chaos, disorder. Life was fucked up. Life wasn't tidy and lovey-dovey. And where was the fun in just floating along in ignorant bliss anyways? It was always more fun to make a mess of things. And this is what Jimbo thought while he made his way through the throngs of smiling San Franciscans, pausing to take in Timothy Leary's speech from the stage. And the one-time Harvard professor and LSD prophet, recently touring college campuses to spread the good word of the acid trip, rang forth with a mantra that the whole movement would adopt. The movement that was taking form here and now in Golden Gate Park. Turn on, tune in, drop out. Drop out. Jimbo fixated on those final words. He plucked them from Leary's entire sentence and kept on repeating them out loud, quietly at first, and then louder. It was his own mantra now. He spun around in the public park in the cozy January sunshine, yelling, "Drop out!" at all the smiling faces. Jimbo plucked a flower from behind the ear of a teenage girl with long blonde hair. He squeezed it in his palm until the petals had been ripped off and the stem was crumpled, and then he let it droop and fall to the ground. The girl looked on in horror. He snatched a joint from the fingers of a short-haired flower child, some young kid who was in the early stages of letting it all hang out. Jimbo snatched the joint and just ate it, stuck the lit roach in his mouth and started to chew. He smiled while his cheeks moved up and down and then blew residual smoke right back into the kid's face. Fuck him, he thought. He grabbed girls' dresses and pulled them sky high to get a peep, deliberately bumped his rugged shoulder into the shoulders of passing kids with rose-colored glasses and gobsmacked faces.
Fuck you, pencil neck.
And he would really dig his shoulder in, too, set them reeling, flailing backward, and then follow up with a bloated, drunk confrontation.
What the fuck is your problem?
Jim Morrison trailed Jimbo, stoned and drunk as usual, chuckling at Jimbo's hijinks, but also affording himself the luxury of keeping his distance. There was plenty going on in January 1967, but on this particular Saturday, San Francisco was certainly where it was at. The Human Being, a prelude to that year's Summer of Love, was billed as a gathering of the tribes, and truly, it was. Hippie kids walked side by side with businessmen in suits. Everyone was encouraged to breathe a little deeper and take things a little slower, peacefully protest the war, love one another, smile upon another, look at the world in a different way, come together. Rainbow-colored posters for the mass event asked people to bring flowers, incense, feathers, and candles, to bring animals, cymbals, chimes, and flutes. Organizers expected about 1,000 people to show up at Golden Gate Park's Polo Fields, but guesstimates put the actual number of attendees between 20 and 30,000. Other posters promised all SF rock groups, which translated to a who's who of San Francisco rock and roll circa early 1967. The Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, the Sir Douglas Quintet, the Quicksilver Messenger Service, and Big Brother and Holding Company. Big Brother had yet to release a debut record yet, but they were making waves in the scene largely due to their lead vocalist, Janis Joplin. It was also the first major counterculture gathering that used the local Hell's Angels chapter for security, seeing as there was no police presence. And they passed out drinks from the back of a station wagon, helped lost kids find their free-flowing parents, and for the most part, stayed out of trouble. And there was a general sense of unease at the Angels' presence. After all, they had attacked anti-war protesters the year before and carried with them an overall air of menace that Jimbo found delightfully ironic. A couple of hits of acid from Allen Ginsberg and Ken Kesey, though, kept them on their best behavior for the moment.
"You know what I see when I look out at this crowd?"
Jimbo asked Jim, draping his arm around Jim's shoulders and pulling him in close.
"I see a whole lot of people who aren't happy, who want something else. And they don't want to be told what to do by City Hall and the President and the fucking pigs, man. They sure as shit ain't gonna get what they want by holding hands in Golden Gate fucking Park, neither."
Jimbo snorted up a real big loogie and spat it out onto the ground, tugged at his crotch and looked around at the hippie dream gathering steam in the wide expanse of the Polo Fields, and saw it bursting, a loud resounding pop. Revolution was not this immaculate.
"This won't last, Jim. I see these crowds rising up, getting angry. They'll get tired trying to give peace a chance. They'll just be dying to go crazy, and they'll want someone to show them how, to tell them that it's okay, to tell them that they don't have to listen to their parents or the cops. Fuck the parents. Fuck the cops. Fuck society. All these motherfuckers want is self-expression. They want to be left alone and allowed to do whatever they want, whenever they want. And the Hell's Angels? They're like wolves, man. Wolves in sheep's clothing, brother. You know it. What the fuck do they get out of this? They're gonna flash their true colors, too. People will say, those Hell's Angels went crazy. But you know. You know that the Hell's Angels are just gonna do what the Hell's Angels do. Fuck shit up."
The crowd around them started to back away. A large empty circle was formed in the grass as people pushed each other back and the sound of anticipatory conversation increased. Jim thought it had something to do with Jimbo at first, Was he being too loud? Was he now scaring off large groups of calm peace seekers? He noticed that the crowd, now oohing and aahing, was looking to the sky. Little white tablets rained down on them all. Owsley's white lightning, recently made illegal in the state of California. Acid tabs were falling from the sky like manna from heaven. Jim smacked Jimbo on the chest, the universal sign in this sort of situation for shut the fuck up, pointed upwards. A parachuter was making his descent from the deep blue sky above, a plane tailing off in the distance as its engine sputtered and gurgled. The parachuter tossed white lightning tabs here and there, the hands from the crowd reaching out and grabbing the promise of another trip. And they squealed with joy in this Wild West field full of love and compassion and altered states of mind. Jimbo was unimpressed, though, as Jim could tell by the one-syllable grunt he made under his breath. And then he turned to Jim and said,
"Turn on. Tune in. Fuck you."
Jim Osterberg knew a fellow dropout when he saw one. And this guy on stage at the University of Michigan's intramural sports building, this guy was a colossal, scene-shifting, pants-shitting dropout. He hit the stage late, stumbled around like a buffoon, grabbed the microphone and mumbled a litany of off-color remarks and curse words. The kind of shit you didn't say in public. The kind of shit you definitely didn't say at the university's homecoming concert. In his untucked white dress shirt and dark leather pants, he could barely stand upright. Jim witnessed Jim and thought, takes one to know one. For Jim Osterberg, Jim Morrison was an inspiration. The rest of the audience didn't share Jim Osterberg's excitement. The rest of the audience was pissed, felt screwed over, and they paid $3 for this train wreck. And the students in the audience expected better things from performers at the University of Michigan's homecoming show. Performers like the Righteous Brothers, Dionne Warwick, the Four Tops, the Beach Boys. Consummate performers who knew how to deliver a show. Give them a bang for $3. The Doors should have been that band. All signs pointed to that band. A band that would wow them. A band that was grabbing hold of some corner of the country zeitgeist at the moment. In the fall of 1967, the Doors were on top of the world. They released their self-titled debut album that year. Elektra bought them a huge billboard in the Sunset Strip, the first of its kind for a rock and roll band. The first single from the record, Break On Through to the Other Side, didn't live up to its title, but its follow-up made up for lost time. Light My Fire spent 23 weeks on the Billboard charts, peaking at number one for three of those weeks. Light My Fire, cut down from its 7-minute album length to a barely 3-minute radio version, was everywhere during the summer of 67. Jim Morrison threw down his hit single money for a custom black leather suit, walked that walk, and skin-tight pants. It's hard to overstate just how revolutionary Light My Fire was when it appeared in the pop charts. For weeks before Light My Fire debuted, the number one slot on the Billboard charts was held by songs like Windy by The Association, Groovin' by the Young Rascals, and Happy Together by the Turtles. Bubblegum pop ruled the airwaves, and Light My Fire was an invitation to explore something well off the beaten path of pop conformity, not to mention the gateway to an album version that was more than twice the single's length. The Doors' debut altered the public's perception towards what a number one song could be. They followed up quickly in the early fall with Strange Days, which was immediately a hit. Its singles, People Are Strange and Love Me Two Times, would do well even if they weren't generation-defining songs like Light My Fire. Crawdaddy magazine called their live show beautiful and frightening and said that the Doors in concert were the best the West has to offer. And just like the epic The End closed out the debut record, Strange Days featured an equally long coda, When the Music's Over, that the band would transform into dramatic, dynamic, improvisational rock and roll live. When they were firing on all cylinders, move aside, and they could swim to the moon, climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide. And they were ascending. But in Ann Arbor, Michigan, they got caught on a rung. When the band first appeared on stage, following the local opening group, the Long Island Sound, Jim wasn't even there. Ray, Robbie, and John picked up their instruments and began to vamp on Soul Kitchen. once the audience realized that they were just going to play without their frontman, Ray's twittering organ line repeating over and over again, the boos started. And this was going to be disastrous. They needed Jim, no matter what state he was in. Ray knew he was stone drunk backstage. He had been nursing a whiskey bottle all day, not all afternoon, all day, morning, noon, night. The band stopped playing and exited the stage. They came back minutes later with Jim. They started up Soul Kitchen again, this time with their frontman front and center. Jim tripped on his own feet, fell over, pulled himself up on the microphone stand, tripped again, threw his wild mane of hair backwards. He was beyond wasted. And that's when he started cursing into the mic. He pulled it close against his lips, completely missing the insistent heartbeat rhythm of Soul Kitchen and rambling on. He thought about Jimbo rambling to him and channeled it. Just let it come through him, rambling man. And the mic was tight against his lips and his words were muffled, stunted, slurred.
Fucking goddamn. Soul Kitchen, fuck.
The kids in the audience were shocked. Not that they didn't say fuck themselves, but bands on stage did not say fuck. Jim picked up debris from the stage, a beer can, a pencil, a crumpled up piece of paper from his pocket, and chucked it at the audience. Whatever he could get his hands on, whatever wasn't tied down.
Come on, you pussies.
Jim shouted, his face not directly in front of the mic, but close enough that a handful of the audience were able to hear his taunts. And they started to get upset. Jim was drunk, he was late, he was insulting the audience, and now he was daring the audience to what? To challenge him? To rush the stage? To take him on? The cops stepped in before things got out of hand and ushered Jim and the band off stage. And the Long Island Sound stepped in to soften the blow and began playing again. And backstage, Jim breathed heavy, and the heavy breathing of a man who was feeling the tug of war between whiskey and LSD in his system. The heavy breathing of a man who, drunk or not, had the crowd in the palm of his hand and set them reeling. He had control. To Jim Osterberg, it was theater. It was expression. It was something new, big, dumb, confrontational, alive. It definitely wasn't Elvis Presley, and it wasn't the fucking Beatles. It was the future. Jim Osterberg took what he had seen back to his bandmates in the Psychedelic Stooges. He had a vision. He'd ride the Jim Morrison character to the extreme, to the next level. Transcendentally dumb, insightfully idiotic, artfully primitive, the Psychedelic Stooges changed their name to simply The Stooges, and Jim Osterberg started calling himself Iggy Pop. Jim Morrison, meanwhile, had put Ann Arbor on the map as yet another location for his crowd-baiting antics. It wasn't the complete insanity he imagined and the kinds of fantasies Jimbo helped him envision. That would come soon enough. The next step would involve authority, cops. Soon enough, when the tour rolled into New Haven, Connecticut, Jim would ratchet up that spectacle. And it would take him weeks to get the taste of the mace off of his tongue. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. All right, the 27 Club is scored and co-written by myself, Jake Brennan. Seth Lundy is the lead writer and editor on the show. Matt Bowden mixes the show. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. The 27 Club is released weekly every Thursday. Season 1 features 12 episodes on Jimi Hendrix, which are all available for you to binge right now, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe to the 27 Club on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your shows. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media. And we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. And you're going to want to give that a follow. So get out there and spread the word about 27 Club. And as always, you can find me blabbing about other crazy rock stars on my other show, Disgraceland. And you can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter at DisgracelandPod. Rock and roll.